Hello and welcome to the Epic Echo Media Musings. In this podcast, we'll look at the movies and TV shows you know and love and the things in them that we don't love so much. We'll shed our insight on the problematic pieces of the media we consume while giving you tips to use those pieces to start great conversations. The point of our podcast isn't that you stop watching your favorite shows and movies, but instead to help you use them to start empowering conversations with the folks you watch them with. Enjoy. Hello, and welcome to a brand new episode of Media Musings. This episode will kick off our summer series of the show with episodes starting next month. Today, we're talking about a very public court hearing we're all sure you've heard of, the trial featuring Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. Before we jump in, I'll introduce my guests on today's episode. I'm joined by Amber Ross Chapman, Director of Client Services at one of our sister agencies, Branches Domestic Violence Shelter in Huntington, West Virginia. And I'm also joined by Epic Executive Director and a frequent guest on the Epic Echo, Katie Spriggs. Thank you guys so much for being here with me today. We have a lot to dive into. It's going to be very informal. We just kind of want to dance around this topic. It's been everywhere. We can't not see it both in our personal and professional lives. So if we just kind of want to start out with giving like a general take of what's been going on through our professional lens, that would be great.
Amber, I'll let you start.
Perfect. The general take is, man, I wish everyone cared about domestic violence every day the way they care about this defamation case that is continually about domestic violence and who's guilty and really, you know, breaking down every single moment, every single look, every single outfit. It would just be really nice if everyone had a wider lens on domestic violence and cared this much every single day. That being said, I am also watching every single day and getting upset, so that says something about me as well, I admit. But, you know, I just wish people cared and engaged a little bit more.
Yeah, I second what Amber said. That's kind of my overall view of it, too, is I wish A, that people cared this much every day about domestic violence that occurs in their own communities. And then B, I wish that there was a better understanding of the court system and how it works. And I know we're going to dive into the difference between these hearings and like domestic battery hearings, for instance. But I wish that there was just a better of general understanding in the public surrounding A, the court systems and how they work, and then B, how they affect the people who are experiencing them. Because I think that's something we're all missing when we talk about this is who's guilty and who's not is sort of irrelevant in like, how is everyone affected by it, everyone involved? And I wish we were paying a little bit more attention to that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you both more. For anyone that's a frequent listener of the Echo, you're probably wondering why there are so many folks on the call. Typically, our interviews are only two. But as we've stated already, this trial is bringing up so much that I really just think we need to bring all hands on deck to have this conversation so that we're seeing this through multiple lenses. I mean, we have two directors who have worked in client services and then me being a prevention educator and our community coordinator. So we're getting a lot of different lenses here. And I thought that was important. Given the sudden outburst, especially of media attention that's being turned towards domestic violence, although this isn't a domestic violence hearing, I thought it was really important that we gave this platform over to address some of the conversations that we're seeing, because these conversations, whether we're thinking about it in the moment or not, are carrying over into the way that we perceive domestic violence in the real world, which some folks may argue and say that that is the real world, but I don't know about you guys. I wouldn't even imagine suing someone for $50 million in my real world. That's pretty far out from my reach and my grasp of reality. I do want to clarify just before we get in, we are not going to be discussing the details of this case involving Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. We are not going to get into detail. We're not going to bring up quotes from trial. That's not what today is about. Today is about the overarching picture of what this trial is doing, how it's impacting us and our agencies and our communities as a whole. What we're here to do is address language that we use to talk about issues like this, the way that we share media, what these real cases for real people actually look like in our communities. And most importantly, we are not here to provide you with a verdict. We are not going to tell you who we think is guilty or not guilty. That's not what we're here to do today. We're here to talk about the impact of this case overall. So Katie, I'm going to go ahead and throw it back to you first, because I think before we kind of dive in too much, I want folks to really understand what this court case looks like and how that compares to the cases that we see in our work every day.
Yeah, that's a great question. So to make one immediate clarification, this is a defamation hearing. What they are looking at is if the accusations that Amber made confidentially, well, without naming names, I guess, you know, something she published years ago, if that affected Johnny Depp's career moving forward. This is not a criminal hearing. And I think that is the part that is frustrating when you watch it as someone who sits through, testifies in criminal hearings all the time, because the difference in the way the evidence is presented is significant. So in a criminal hearing, when you're looking at domestic violence, which in West Virginia will often be called domestic battery or domestic assault, which are both misdemeanors in the state. When you're looking at a criminal hearing, they are the source of what they're trying to figure out, what the both sides are trying to prove, is the state or the, you know, the prosecutor is trying to prove that the perpetrator was the primary aggressor. So you're looking at who is the primary aggressor in the situation. This is what law enforcement, this is how they investigate domestic violence. This is how it's prosecuted. So primary aggressor means the one that holds the power and control. That doesn't necessarily mean the one that engaged in any physical violence in the moment, because there can be reactionary violence, which is a whole nother podcast all on its own. We'll touch on that one day, I'm sure. But to clarify, this case is not looking at who committed violence against who. It's looking and how that violence affected everyone involved. It's looking at if someone's reputation was harmed. So the way that this evidence is being presented and talked about is a lot different than it would be in a regular criminal trial, but the general public often doesn't understand the difference. So they're looking at it as if they have all the answers or they have all the information to make their own guilty or non-guilty verdict in their minds. But in reality, they don't have all the information. No one except for the two people in the relationship do in this instance. And it wasn't investigated like a crime would have been investigated. So that is, I think, and Amber, I'd love if you have any insight, that is the foundational difference between this hearing and what we normally would see in a criminal case.
I would just say, hear, hear, amen. Normally, I don't say those things, but yeah, it just becomes, you know, your friend or your neighbor or, you know, just anyone with access to internet and Wi-Fi becoming an expert on this case and these people, whenever it's like, hey, the people that you see that are experiencing domestic violence are not really going to be on this realm. So the takes that people have, they're just dangerous. And, mm-hmm. you know, domestic violence, we know, is not a sexy topic, but, you know, those topics that they say avoid at the dinner table, like politics and religion, I would say domestic violence is one of those topics. And now it's just thrown out where everyone's talking about them mm-hmm. and being like, well, did you see this? Did you see that? This representation is bad. This representation is good. And it's just weird.
It's also it's very strange to me to observe when people, which I've done this myself previously in my life and probably more recently than I'd like to admit, is when you listen to the story of someone going through domestic violence or experiencing a violent act, they say, well, I wouldn't have done that. Or if, you know, so-and-so was really the victim, they wouldn't have done that. And that's the core of what's most dangerous. Because what you're telling survivors who did that, so that thing, whatever that thing is that you wouldn't have done, you're telling survivors who did it that they shouldn't have done it and that it was their fault. And that's the core of what's dangerous. And I know when people are saying it, like, I would never have done that. I wouldn't have reacted that way. I would have cried. I wouldn't have laughed, whatever. They don't realize the impact of their words, right? They don't realize that people are listening. Their kids are listening. Their families are listening. Their friends are listening. And they're hearing that what they did wasn't good or wasn't healthy or wasn't productive. But in reality, domestic violence is trauma against the body and the mind. And people's reactions to trauma are unpredictable. No one can predict them, even the person themselves. So it's that, I think, is the core of where the way we talk about this hearing and other hearings like it can do harm, unintended harm.
I agree. And I think it forces survivors, someone who is experiencing abuse, to try to be perfect when they are just trying to survive. Like, sorry that I don't have all my ducks in a row. I'm going through a crisis right now. So to pinpoint those behaviors, and now everyone will associate good and bad with just trying to survive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I'm noticing a lot of on social media is that folks are used to seeing very dramatized courtrooms on screens. So when we think about watching a courtroom proceeding on a screen, we're thinking about Law and Order SVU or something similar to that, where these cases are very dramatized and there's always like a huge aha moment or like a gotcha moment. And obviously, First key, those are actual criminal trials that we're watching. Although dramatized, they are still criminal proceedings. This one is not. And B, although this one feels very dramatized because these are folks that we're used to seeing in those settings, in those false settings, it's still not. We still need to take this into consideration. Although these folks aren't the people you're seeing in your community, these are actual people that we can't talk about as if they're characters in movies. Even those characters in movies, hint, hint, ding, ding, that's what this podcast is about. Those opinions are trickling over into our real lives as well. But it's also important to remember that those judges and those lawyers and those people that you're interacting with on your screens are actual real people who have to go out into their communities after this as well. And I will also say, for some folks, this is the first actual trial that they may have ever seen. I know that until I came into this field of work, I had never been inside of a courtroom. I had never seen anything like this take place. So I know that there are other people out there that were like me. And I've noticed that there's a huge outpouring of shock and disbelief at the type of questioning that's being asked in these trials. Like, why are they spending so long talking about this? Or why are they even bringing that up? And so I also wanted to touch before we moved on past the actual court proceedings, that that's the type of support that those people in your community need. They are the ones that are actually having their lives, their reputations, intimate details broadcast to an entire courtroom full of people, sometimes repeatedly over and over and over again. So when this trial goes away, if we can take some things with us, which although the outcome seems like it might not impact our perception so far, I do want folks to just realize that like those are the actual types of questions and like the actual types of details that the people in your community are being forced to share. So when you see those folks or when someone discloses this type of thing to you, I want to make sure that we're understanding that that's what we're seeing, except for in real life courtrooms.
Yeah. And if there's any, golden sort of like something that we hope people take away from this experience that we're all having as a nation is how hard this process is on someone's self, family, body, brain, how traumatizing it is for everybody involved to go and have these things aired to a whole courtroom. And often, by the way, a jury of their peers. So that's the other thing that we're leaving out is this case is in Fairfax, Virginia. Neither of these people live in Fairfax, Virginia or work in Fairfax, Virginia normally. And in our community in Berkeley County, if there were to be a trial, it's a jury of their peers, Berkeley County residents. They live and work and breathe here. And they're surrounded by people who could see them on the streets after that, after hearing some of the worst details of their life. So I think that if there's anything we can take away from that, it's hopefully that the general world at large has a better understanding of at least what happens and how that might make someone feel.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we've kind of touched a good bit on the case itself. I do also now, I would like to get your expertise, Amber. If you would just kind of tell us what the difference in, these two individuals versus the people that we see in our agencies every day. If you could just kind of explain for folks why we are having to make statements like this or why we are having to really focus on this. Because people really seem to know the ins and outs, or they think that they know the ins and outs of this relationship. And therefore that's the be all end all of domestic violence. But if you could just kind of shed some light from direct services, from advocacy, just like, how does this compare to the work that we do?
Of course. And, you know, thank you for asking. That's one of the big things that we want to take away from this, like we're talking about today. But one of the best parts that I can take away from this case is that at least these two people specifically seem safe. Again, I don't know Johnny Depp or Amber Heard, but it appears that they have gotten out of their situation and they're in a safer place. They can now come to court. And that's not really our starting point with a lot of the people that we are seeing. Normally, safety is our first goalpost, and it's the first thing that we are trying to accomplish with people. And that could mean that we are contacting people who are currently living with their abuser and we're safety planning to get out, or someone who has just immediately fled from their abuser and they're looking for somewhere else to go. So seeking either immediate permanent housing or emergency shelter. And very honestly, even though the movement is moving more toward mobile services that puts people into housing quicker, we don't have a lot of emergency shelters and domestic violence specific emergency shelters. So the people that we are seeing are in that crisis of, where am I going to lay my head tonight? Will I have food? What about my children? Before they can even really get to the point where they're thinking about income and the relationships of the people that they know and they see every day. So that's where we start with our survivors. And just luckily enough, everyone's viewing this case and these two people are safe. Most of our survivors are not, and we are. And we work with them for years to get to a point where income is something that they can, you know, think about and actually gravitate toward and make goals to work toward. Katie, would you have anything else?
Yeah, I would agree completely that, yeah, this is steps ahead of where the average domestic violence survivor in your community is. This is something many of them couldn't even imagine, just like we were all talking about, like $50 million. None of us can imagine that. But I will also point out that there is some privilege wrapped up in this, some economic privilege from both of them, that this is even something they can access, that they could pay these attorneys. This is not, again, not a criminal hearing. These attorneys are not appointed. They're not state attorneys or defense attorney. Like, these are paid attorneys from both people. And so we struggle still in West Virginia and probably across the nation for just like general court access. I need to be able to get to courthouse to file a protective order. And that in and of itself is 100 steps. So I think also understanding that this is not something that most survivors have access to.
Gotcha. So we kind of talked a little bit at the opening about this kind of idea of the perfect survivor and the ways that we think survivors should respond to things. I also was hoping that you two would touch on what survivors can come to us appearing like, and then the way that advocates are able to see through the appearances or the perceptions of survivors to just get to the work of making people in our communities safer.
Yeah, I can start. I think this is a hard one because survivors can present in various ways. So like, for instance, one of the things when we train new advocates, we train a lot on trauma and what it does to the body and what it does to the brain in real time and, you know, years later. And the one, you know, situation I always present is one of the things that we do is we respond to the hospital 24/7. For acute sexual assault or domestic violence cases. So these are people who are just fresh out of the assault and they're seeking medical intervention, no matter what form that might be. And I did that response for many years of my life. And the one thing that I learned rather quickly is that none of them are ever the same. So I have walked into hospital rooms 3 hours after an assault and the survivor was laughing. I've walked in and they were basically unconscious. I have walked in and they are mute. They don't speak. I have seen every single gamut of response. And so that I will start by saying that I think in order to understand someone's presentation, you have to understand trauma and what it does to a person. And so that reigns true for this hearing as well, right? Like we, regardless of what we might believe about either one of them, it's clear that they have both gone through some trauma in their lives at the hands of each other and whatever. And the way that they present to the public and the way people are observing them and watching them is formed by what has happened to them, just as it is for all of us. And I think that's something important to keep in mind too, is people are judging the way they look or the way they act or the way they talk or the way they laugh or whatever, not understanding that all of that is informed by A, the fact that they know millions of people are watching, and B, what has happened to them in the past and what they're talking about in the present.
I agree. I think the fact that both of these people work in the entertainment industry is something that a lot of people are maybe not focusing on as much. They do know that a lot of people are looking at them, and that could probably force their hand as well in how they're reacting. And again, it's just not usually what we're getting, at least from my experience. It's a wide range of reactions. Someone who is, like I said, immediately fleeing a crisis might not be on their best behavior, or they will be. It's just something that you grow to not expect from someone. So that's the piece that's important, is lowering or managing your expectations of what you think people should be reacting like, and just opening your ears, like listening to what people are telling you is really, really important. And at the end of the day, even if someone is a good person or someone's a bad person, I would like to say that I don't think anyone deserves to experience domestic violence. And that's where I stand on it.
Yeah, I completely agree. Especially in this trial that's very public. I think that's what, without saying it, that's what people are really touching on, is that we think that every survivor of domestic violence should act this way. They should react this way. They should talk this way. But in reality, I mean, we are the people that are serving the actual survivors that you live with and that you interact with on a day-to-day basis. And we are here to tell you that that's just not reality. There is no concept of a perfect survivor. They come to us in all different ways, in all different forms. And they all need like a different level of support from us and a different type of support from us. And so I just want people to realize that that's why we are here. And that's why we're having this conversation today.
Yeah. And you know what we do as humans? We avoid danger, right? Like that's the natural response, is to avoid danger. So what will happen to people over time who've experienced trauma, specifically violent trauma, is they will take, we call them danger avoidance tactics. So they present with some danger avoidance tactics. So that could be not looking someone in the eye. It could be nervous laughter to fill silence. It could be coming off, Amber, Nora, we all run shelters. We know what this is like. It could be when they walk into the shelter and they won't speak to anyone. It could, like, all of these things. But if you look at them for what they are, it's avoiding future danger. And it's whatever they think might work to avoid the danger, or whatever their body thinks might work. They might not even be in control of it. So I think that's important to talk about when you talk about any domestic, violence, any trauma on the body, is that they are going to do whatever it takes to prevent future danger. And that looks different to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We're touching on some really, really good stuff here. I hate to be the one that always redirects, but I do want to make sure that we also get to touch a little bit deeper. We've brushed past it, but I want to really let folks know what you're actually doing when you're sharing things about this trial on social media. So for example, in preparation for this episode, I did a lot of deep diving across a couple of platforms of social media. So I looked into Twitter, I looked into Instagram, Facebook, and then I also looked into TikTok. These are all platforms that our agency uses to engage with our community. And so I wanted to kind of deep dive and look at what our community was seeing. So as I was doing my deep dive, I kind of like white knuckle on the laptop was like stressed. Like I am like breaking out into cold sweats when I'm reading the type of things that people are saying online, and not only their opinions, which I mean, everybody has a right to, and everybody's going to have, whether you share it publicly or not, you're probably going to share it privately. So everyone has an opinion about this trial already. Everybody's made up their mind. They know the facts. They know the details. They know who's guilty and who's not guilty. Although that's not even what the people within the courtroom are trying to figure out. We seem to, as a society, think that we have figured it out. But also just the fact that I had to scroll for less than 5 minutes to see actual video, to hear audio, to see images of actual violence, of actual, like, you know, verbal abuse, of bruises, of the actual courtroom proceedings, of hearing graphic details of sexual assault. This took me less than 5 minutes just searching the names to find, or even not. When I went through TikTok, I actually was just scrolling through our For You page, and it was just within 5 minutes, the live courtroom feed was on my, like, For You page. It was just right there for me to see. And I want folks to know that although Johnny Depp and Amber Heard are never going to see the comments that you have to say about their relationship, the survivors that are interacting with your social media are seeing that every day. They are getting triggered by the violence that they're seeing, by the violence that they're hearing, and by the perception that you have of them. Wondered if you guys wanted to touch on that a little bit as well.
Oh, for sure. I agree with everything you just said. It's incredibly dangerous, and it's harmful to people who will actually see it. As Nora said, Johnny Depp and Amber Heard will not. Their friends will not. Your friends will. And even if you think you're right, that's where it gets so, like, you're like, I am for sure, I'm on team whoever. Yeah, I'm 100% in. It's team that person. They definitely are the poor, you know, the perpetrator. The other person's definitely the victim, which again is not what this trial is figuring out. So you haven't even been presented with the evidence that would let you assume that. What if, so, like, I'll give a real life scenario. Let's say, you know, friend A, your friend Bob on Facebook experienced the similar type of domestic violence as this person that you're saying is lying. You just told Bob that he's lying in Bob's mind, right? So now you've lost that connection. That friend doesn't see you as safe anymore. It doesn't, it's not helping anyone, right? To share who that you're so confident in, this thing that you're so right about, and this other person's a liar. No one was in that relationship but them. They truly are the only ones who knows the ins and outs of it. And you're not even getting that evidence presented in that way that would help to get to the bottom of that, because it's not the purpose of this hearing. So I think it's especially dangerous in cases like this to make an assumption, because you don't even have all the information, because that's the point. It's not the point of this hearing to give you all that information. Amber, I'm sure you have tons of insight.
I'm still just mind blown, because I had not even thought, Nora, what you were talking about. The amount of, like, timelines and TikToks, different platforms that I've seen this come up. Man, I don't think I've seen a trigger warning once. Not at all. Like, all of these people are examining this topic so hotly that, like, I've not seen a trigger warning. That's insane to me. This is accountability that we hold for, like, TV shows. And, you know, we really put people under fire for how they handle the topics. But we, as people with TikToks and Twitters and Facebooks, aren't giving that same kind of response. That's insane. Still stuck on that. Good work. Thank you for making me think today. But also, I just want to point out that all of these platforms have limited, like, characters that you can use. They're little short caps. In order to gauge and get someone's attention. And just imagine if, like, your worst day was an article, a TikTok, and that's what people were taking away from it. So again, your survivors or people who are experiencing our abuse are like, oh, well, I'll never report to them, or maybe I'll never report to anyone. So it's really important to think about those things. And be careful about the spaces that you're creating for people, either physically or just on your social media. Like, I had never thought how important social media was, but, like, we're out there putting our opinions out there. No one's asking. So that's just an easy way for someone who can't speak to a person they know to identify, well, this is a safe place for me to report. And that's safe and dangerous.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm guilty of being in this field for 10 years and becoming desensitized to how much seeing it, hearing it can affect people. I have some sort of magical ability to not be affected by it in the moment. I store it up and will, like, realize later, I'm like, wow, I'm not doing well. It's probably because I've heard 300 horrible instances in the last week. So I have to, like, check myself with that often. And it's scary because that's what's happening, right? To the whole nation is when they see it, they see guilty, not guilty. They see, an incidence of domestic violence that they'll even laugh at. They've made jokes out of it on TikTok. That's dangerous. Domestic violence is one of the leading causes of death in women in the United States, West Virginia specifically. So people legitimately die from this, and it's a TikTok. So that part, and kids are seeing that, and young adults are seeing that, and the older generation who already is less likely to report are seeing it. So like, I agree with you, Amber. I think you have to remember that we as a nation always say report, report, report. If you don't report, it didn't happen. But then we're also giving examples of why you would never report, because this is what happens when you do, right? And I will also point out, neither of these two people reported this as a crime. It's, again, a defamation hearing. So again, circling back to the difference between a criminal investigation and this.
Yeah, I think, Katie, what you said about becoming desensitized, although that is very unique to our field, people like all over social media platforms are more desensitized than they are willing to admit. The type of images that you can find on social media of just horrible graphic violence, the type of like one-on-one takes that you can read of someone that's just actively, I mean, I see it all the time with the type of media that I engage in with our agency social media, people that disclose publicly to their abuse, which is your right. I am so glad that people feel empowered to use their voices on social media. But I also think that it's all of our responsibility to make sure that if we're sharing that type of information, you're at least bare minimum going to accompany that with some resources so that if someone comes across that may be triggered, the least you can do for sharing that piece of information is to accompany it with, I support you. Here's where you can go if this triggers you. Here's where you can go if you need support. And both of our agencies, both Branches and Epic, are, I think, great examples of the type of resources that you could be sharing, at least bare minimum, like I said, alongside with your opinions, with your takes, and with the information. And then I also want to touch on the fact that the way that the media, specifically like not social media, but the media, I use air quotes, is covering this. I think we've kind of forgotten a little bit that the job of the like news outlets is shock and awe. They want ratings and they want views. So the reason that they're using these like really grabbing headlines, or that they are starting their articles with a photo of bruised faces or with audio clips of describing very vivid details of assault, the reason that they're doing that is because they want you to read it. It's not because they're trying to inform you or educate you. It's because they want you to click on their article so that you will see their ads, so that more coins will jingle in their pockets. That is 100% the only reason that those types of outlets are sharing this information. So that's why we at our agencies are now forced to combat it with the actual awareness and education that we're doing here today.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Here, here, as Amber says.
We touched on the media piece now. I think that was super important. There's one like really big piece that I still want to touch on before we wrap things up today. And I'm hoping that you all will have a little bit of insight to add to this as well. At the end of this trial, I want this, and we've already touched on it, but I want to reinstate that this is not going to choose who was the abuser and who was the victim. There's not going to be a distinction between the two of them at all in this way. That is not what this trial is here to do. No matter how like intimately you dive into the details, and no matter how many times you watch or read anything about this, they're still not going to give you a verdict at the end that is going to tell you who is guilty of abuse and who is a victim of abuse. That's not going to happen. So although we already seem to have made our own decision as a society, the court system is not even going to be making that distinction at the end of this trial.
Yeah, that's important to remember. And I think, I think there's so many pieces to that to unpack. One of them being the amount of people invested in this and invested in the outcome is alarming. And I think we haven't even seen the worst of this portrayal in the media yet. I think when it ends, that'll be the worst, because there's going to be people who are unhappy with how it ends. But again, I remind you, this is someone's actual life, right? Like people's actual lives. And this isn't a movie. We're used to seeing these people in movies. And I will also just one small note, that's another big takeaway that I would like people to remember, is they are not the characters that they play. So people are attached to the characters they've seen these people play, you know, from Pirates of the Caribbean to Aquaman, but they are not those people in real life, right? So I think that's another thing. You don't know their character in real life. Like no one that posts about this that I've seen knows both of these people personally. So that's another thing to take away from the end of the trial, is this is the end of their public trial, but their lives will continue in their community with people who love them. And I think that's important to take away as it wraps up as well.
I agree. Even if these people are living on a grander scale, just again, full stop, they're people. They are people, they have lives to live. And I hope, though I have some fears, that both of these people can move on and live a safe life, free from any part of this case, previous cases. I hope they are just safe and they live a long life. And I hope that people feel the same for survivors of abuse who are going into criminal civil court hearings in different forms. Just safety. Just think about safety.
And celebrate that they are both safe, to our knowledge, now.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I wrap up and I touch on our key points, I just want to add one more thing through my lens, through the prevention lens. One of the ways that we as a society, and then also as prevention educators like me, aim to prevent sexual violence from occurring and domestic violence as well, is by changing the social norms that accept and allow it, which some people don't really understand because you think that preventing violence means intervening. But intervention and prevention are two different words for a reason, and they have two different meanings for a reason. So one of the ways that we aim to prevent violence is to change the way that we perceive violence. So that's what we really have done here today, is we've put on our prevention hats and we've kind of given you all of the tools that we have in our tool belts to equip yourself to go out and spread this awareness and education, instead of just having these conversations where we're pointing fingers at the victim or at the abuser. We can actually start to have these conversations about the way that it's rolling over and that it's impacting the violence in our communities. So I just wanted to touch on that very briefly. It's all impacting the way that we think and the way that we perceive actual domestic violence cases in our communities. So if we have the tools of awareness and education in our back pockets, then we can begin to actually have conversations that matter, instead of these just very opinion-based conversations that we're seeing a lot of. So please, please use these tools that we've given you. I'm going to wrap up now with some of our key points that we've touched on today that we can hope that you'll take out into your lives to have these conversations. Starting with what Katie told us, this is not a domestic violence case. This is not a criminal domestic violence hearing. So whatever you're seeing in this trial does not carry over to the survivors that we serve and the survivors that you see in your community. No, the way that the evidence is presented, the way that questioning has happened, none of this is what we actually see. And therefore, you can't compare this to a domestic violence trial in any way, shape, or form, because it's not one. So it's kind of apples to oranges. There's no comparison. We want to reiterate that in real domestic violence cases, safety is key. We, as the agencies that we are, only serve to make sure that people are safe. We do not serve to pass judgment. We do not serve to give a final verdict. We serve to make sure that everyone in our community has a chance at a safe and effective life. And that's what we're doing here today, is we're trying to make sure that our communities are just a little bit safer for the survivors that we do serve. We want to make sure that we all remember that there is no concept of a perfect survivor. That does not exist. No matter what you've seen in this trial, no matter what you've seen in real fictional media, there is no idea of this is what a survivor looks like. And if you deviate from that, then clearly you are not a survivor. That is absolutely false. People react differently to trauma because trauma affects our bodies and our minds, as Katie said. So we want to make sure that we are remembering that whenever someone discloses that they have been a victim of domestic violence or sexual violence, that we just immediately respond with, we believe you. And that's kind of all that you have to do. You're not there to pass judgment and you're not there to provide a verdict. We're just there to make sure that people feel safe coming to us with this information. And that is going to look very different depending on the survivor themselves. And we want to reiterate that Johnny Depp and Amber Heard will never see the comments that you make about this trial online. They're never going to see them. I promise you that. Even if you get 1,000 or 10,000 likes or retweets, they are never going to see it because I promise you they're not seeking it out. So they are never going to see it. The people that will see it are the survivors that you are friends with, the survivors in your family, and the survivors in your communities. So please, 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 if you take nothing else away from this, be careful the type of messaging that you're sharing on your social media about this case. If you share an opinion that you think could be jarring, attach a resource. If you share a video or an audio clip or an image that could potentially be triggering, please, please, please include a content warning. And then also add up some resources and some education along with that. If you're looking for a place to go to find the type of education and the type of awareness materials, please go to Branch's social media. I know they do great. Please go to Epic's social media. I know that we constantly have things going. So there are places that you can go that you can also combat this narrative with the truth and with the facts and with the evidence that we see and that we serve. So that's kind of the key points. Those are the key takeaways I want you to go away with today. Please, when you're having these conversations, consider what we've talked about. Use these new tools that we've given you. That way we can actually start having conversations that matter. I want to thank Katie and Amber. Both of you have been great guests for me today. Thank you so much for all of your insight. If you have anything else to add, please go ahead. And if not, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Just thank you, Nora, for setting it all up, for bringing this topic to light. We have to talk about it. And then also my key takeaway that I actually thought of while Nora was talking about that was to continue to care this much about domestic violence when this hearing is over. Care when you vote. Care when you go, you know, to court, you're in the courthouse, care when you are in your community, care when it's October, Domestic Violence Awareness Month, care about your local shelter, no matter what county you live in West Virginia, there is a shelter that serves that county, figure out who they are, reach out to them, ask how you can help, care this much when this trial is over.
I would say the same. I want to thank you both for having me on and having the conversation that matters, as Nora said. I feel like even I have learned from just speaking with you all. So even if you think that you're the expert and you have the best information and your opinion matters the most, just know that like there's always more to learn, more support that can be provided. And there's more that you can do. So believe survivors. Support survivors in your area and everywhere.
I'm also going to do a shameless plug. If you would like even more content about this case, if you would like even deeper dives than we were able to give you today, I know that Branches is covering this on their podcast as well. So please go to their social media. I will have it linked in the post for this this episode today. Please continue to check that out and support our sister agencies as well. And as always, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Media Musings. Do you have an idea for a TV show or a movie that we should talk about next? Send your ideas over to us at epicwv.org/epic-echo. Thanks for listening.